and welcome back to the Function Health Podcast. My name is Sean Strayer, and I'm here with my co-host Ryan Beck. And today, after a very long time, we're back to deliver the first episode in a long-awaited series called Navigating the Medical School Application Process. This first episode is going to be about the MCAT, and if anybody has even ever thought about going to medical school, they definitely know about the MCAT. And that probably extends to their family and friends that have heard about this process and everything that goes into it. And like pretty much everything in this application process, there's a lot of nuance and there's a lot of stuff that isn't just immediately obvious. And so really with this episode, we're going to dig into what the MCAT is, we're going to break it down, and we're going to try to give you some tips to basically prepare you for this test for when you take it. And I guess a good place to start, Ryan, is what have we been up to in the past 6 months? And why are we able to talk about this with some authority now?
I was just about to tell you the same exact thing. So we've just spent the better part of 2024 preparing for this test and dedicating hours of our time every single day to take this test. So I'm talking 3 to 4 hours a day since January, I'd feel comfortable with saying, preparing for the MCAT. And so that was...
And would you say that's the better part of our year or the worst part of our year?
That was the absolute worst part of my entire life. I'm not going to lie to you. It wasn't a great time.
No. So, you know, and there's ways to mitigate that. And really, if we had a lot of this information going into it, I think it'd be a lot less stressful. But let's take a step back. And for anybody that might not know what the MCAT is, Ryan, can you just kind of cover what the test is and why it's important?
So the MCAT stands for the Medical College Admissions Test. And so this is what a lot of medical schools use to gauge how successful these prospective students are going to be inside of their medical schools. So it's all about making yourself competitive, right? And so there's 4 sections of the MCAT, and we'll go into each one. So there's Chem Phys, there's CARS, and we'll talk about that for a little bit. It's my least favorite subject. Bio, chemistry, and then Psych-Soc.
And yeah, so like you said, pretty much every school uses the MCAT to help stratify incoming students alongside things like GPA and life experience. And what's interesting, I don't know if this is exactly true, but one of the things I read is that success on the MCAT predicts success on Step 1, which is the first test in the U.S. medical licensing exam. And so that's just one of the ways that schools know that you're ready to take such an exam because... You know, like we're going to go into, it's very unique and it's an absolute beast.
And so hopefully in a couple of years, once we take the USMLE Step 1, we can provide you guys with another podcast for giving you guys the successful tips that you need for that. But for now, we're just going to keep talking about the MCAT. And so the MCAT's scored pretty interestingly, and this is up to date as far as 2024. So if you guys are listening to this in the distant future, you guys might need to refer to something other than this podcast. But so the total score ranges from 472 to 528 and with a median of 500. So if you get a score of 500, you're scoring at the 50th percentile. And that's important to note for these different medical schools, because like you might look at this and like, oh, I got 50th percentile, I did okay. But if you take a long look at some of these average MCAT admissions or admissions to the schools and their MCAT scores, it's something silly. Like if you go to Yale and look at their MCAT averages, it's something like 522 or 521, if I'm not mistaken. Is that right?
I believe so, around there. And it's important though, when you are looking at these things, a lot of schools provide the median, and for the most part, they typically don't provide the averages. And so if you think statistically, those are 2 different things, but it still gives you a really good idea. If you look on this website called the MSAR, and we actually also made a spreadsheet that has the majority of the medical schools on it, and those all have the median MCAT scores. But back to what you were saying, right?
It'd probably be a good idea to link those in our show notes at Absolutely. The end of this. Make it a good... I'm very visual with all of my stuff. So the way it's scored for the 4 different sections, they're scored on a scale of 118 to 132. So 118 obviously being your lowest, and your median score for each of these sections is going to be 125. So you get 125 on all 4 sections, you're going to get a score of 500. You're at the 50th percentile. And so all the scoring is based off of the correct answers. So there's no penalty if you just guess on one of these answers, because there's some questions on some of on this test that you have absolute no idea what you're looking at.
And the other important thing when we're talking about scoring is that the scale, it's very it's very wonky, and it doesn't necessarily correlate with, it's not like a regular test where it's correct answers divided by total answers. So how they do it, and really, I really don't think they ever published any true authoritative information on this, which is obviously their discretion. But my understanding is that for a given question, they figure out based on previous years and on this year's how hard that question is, and then they give it weight. So it's essentially a weighted average, not of what's happening on your test day, but of that question of all previous years and this current one. So I think there's a misnomer that a lot of people think it's a straight curve test, meaning that if all my peers do horribly this day and I do pretty decent, I'm going to get a good score. But that's not necessarily the case, because every question gets pulled into this aggregate weighted system. It's not very clear, and either way, you can't rely on what your peers are doing. You want to do the best for yourself. You're really going against yourself in this.
So now we know the median, but what are we shooting for really for these schools?
Yeah, so let's just talk about, and these data change every year, and it's interesting because as people become more prepared for the test, it's actually getting a little bit more competitive each year, meaning that you have to score higher and higher to be in the higher percentiles, if that makes sense. So the average overall MCAT score, like we said, is 500, or that translates to about 125 per section. The average score for admitted students, this is across MD and DO programs, is a 508, which correlates to a 125 to 127 per section. A good score for top medical schools, this is like your top 25, top 15, it's going to be a 515 to a 520. And the average score for DO programs is about 502 to 506.
A good resource to use always at the end of the day is going to just check onto the AAMC website for common dates where you need to register, because there's certain months of the year where you can't even register for the MCAT. And so the cycle every year opens up around,
I think it's when I say October for the next year. That's a really good point, though, because you have to schedule it early. That's a really good point, because you have to schedule it far in advance, and you really want to make sure it's at a testing center that you can get to without traffic and without, you know, where it is.
Yeah, there's people from my testing center coming all the way from St. George to Las Vegas. Mind you, that's only like an hour and a half drive, but that's at 8 a.m.
still. And you're about to take arguably one of the most important tests of your life.
I was sweating. I walked in there sweating.
So, I mean, that is a really big consideration. Now, another thing that you have to consider, and it's not very clear on this because the range of when people take this test is truly all over the place, but one of the things to consider is, when am I going to take this test? When meaning what year of my undergrad am I in, or my postgraduate program? When is the application cycle? And how does it align with my schedule? And, you know, the important thing is, so Ryan, you took it your senior year, right?
Correct. Yeah, I was towards the end of my senior year at UNLV.
And so I took it the end of my, I guess towards the end of my junior year. But granted, neither him or I have a traditional pathway. So what might be junior, senior to us, depending on when you've taken these classes, could be even as early as sophomore year. But I'm just kind of list some prerequisites that you pretty much have to have taken, in my opinion. And because there really is no, I mean, theoretically, you could take the MCAT out of high school. And some people that enter straight into a bachelor to MD program, they do take that, which just blows my mind. But biology 1 and 2, that's a pretty much prerequisite. General chemistry, both series. Organic chemistry, both series. Organic chemistry lab, if that should not be a elective, that is something that you should definitely take. I would say biochemistry, the entire series. Physics, I did not take physics. And Ryan, you finished physics.
I had all of physics 1 under my belt. And I know it's hard for you to believe, but there are kids out there smarter than us. So if they want to get it right out of high school and get after it, let them have it.
But yeah. And so, I mean, that's the point, though. Any of these classes that you don't finish, you could theoretically, we self-taught essentially physics 2 and 3.
In the entirety of psych-soch, mind you. Like, there's no psych-soch background in a biology degree, which is what we both majored in and our undergraduate degrees. And so you have this entire quarter of the test where it's all on you for self-study.
Right. And that's another really good point. If you can take, because even a lot of schools now, they're either requiring or strongly suggesting social sciences like psychology. So that's another really good one to have under your belt.
Mind you, I had a Psych 101 class that was at my community college back when I was still in the active duty. I was like straight up when I was in the clinic. So like that was 2017, I want to say. So 2017. So that's what, 7 years later, I went ahead and took this test.
Right.
And that didn't help at all, to be honest with you. Great guy, great teacher though.
Yeah. And so, and you have to realize that the material that you're going to have to be expected to know, you have to basically learn the language from those class, and then you need to figure out the, I don't know, you could say dialect that the MCAT wants you to know. So Ryan, did you mention, can you think of any other classes? I would say statistics, and I would personally say calculus, if you understand how calculus can apply to things like physics or statistics.
And some of those other, like genetics really did kind of help me a bit. And then there's some evolution on mine, but like it's all catered for each test. So one class might really help you and one class might not be helpful at all. Like immunology was one of my biology electives for my undergraduate degree. And that was tremendous in helping me for the MCAT. And that sometimes that's just how well the teacher is teaching you for that course. And so take it as you will.
And I mean, that's the thing. You know, I mentioned a lot of courses here, and essentially it sounds like I'm telling you, you need to be comfortable with your entire undergraduate coursework. And I don't think that's necessarily the case. I think the case for the MCAT is you have to have a lot of broad knowledge, but I wouldn't say that you have to have a lot of depth unless we're talking about, you know, biochemistry, which even amino acids, that is not much depth when it comes to biochemistry. So I think what we should do now, Ryan, is let's kind of talk through each section, what we feel like is important for each section. And why don't we just go in the order of how they presented on the test? So let's start off with Chem Phys. What are your thoughts on chemistry, physics?
Right. So when you first open up that test, and everyone should take a pretest like early on when they're starting to study. So
we'll
like,
get into that a little later.
Yeah, definitely. But you open up the first thing and there's a lot of passages when it comes to the MCAT. So get comfortable reading 1 to 2 pages of content and then answering in-depth questions about the content that you just read. And so at the end of the day, you don't need to know this discrete knowledge about all this stuff in biochemistry or chemistry and physics sometimes if you just know how to pick apart a passage really, really well. So for the chemistry physics section, so having a solid basis in your equations is going to be super important to begin with. So getting a really good physics equation sheet and just writing them down every day is what I did for.
And we'll link to one in the show notes. Absolutely.
And getting super comfortable with Anki. If you don't know what Anki is yet, and you're studying for your MCAT, and you're listening to this podcast, and you're like, I don't know what to do, and this is why I'm here. Get Anki. Immediately, it's just a flashcard system, and it's fantastic.
Yeah, it's based on the forgetting curve, and it presents you cards right at the end of the forgetting curve so that you're always up to date on it. So with that in mind, with all the equations in mind, what are the flavors of topics that they might present on a chemistry physics section that you remember?
As far as I remember, and it's been a few months, but it's been a rough few months. For chemistry, it's going to bring up something as far back as stoichiometry, like your Chem 1 and 2 days, and you're having to fix stoichiometric coefficients and then balancing equations. And then determining rate kinetics is actually super important, not only just in general chemistry, but also stemming into organic chemistry and the other sciences as well.
And you know, one of the things that you mentioned rate, I actually see, and this might just be a particular thing with some of the students that I've worked with in my class, and I even struggled with this topic for a while. I think it's important, and obviously you'll review this if you're studying for the MCAT, to know the difference between rate and thermodynamic equilibrium. Because a lot of the times they use similar things like K, they use concentrations, but they're different. And I've seen really bright people that know a lot of chemistry, they get screwed up because they get things like rate and thermodynamic equilibrium conflated, and it's incorrect.
If that's what you say, Sean, I wouldn't be able to tell you right now. It's been a few months since I've had to study it, but going into the physics a little bit, like I personally didn't have physics 2 under my belt, and I don't think you did either, right?
I was in the middle of it, but it was mostly self-taught, yeah.
And so my physics 1 class was even a little subpar based on my own opinions, but I dedicated a decent amount of time to it. I really did, and I think I felt the most confident in that section, and I did fairly well on the chem phys section. So like, you don't need to take these classes. You don't necessarily need to. It's just very, very helpful to walk in with the preliminary knowledge already from the classroom.
And another thing is the other section that is sort of similar is biology and biochemistry. But from what I noticed, a lot of the actual organic chemistry mechanisms or organic chemistry lab things like HNMR or infrared spectroscopy, that's all going to come up in Chem Phys. And if you're like me and you love organic chemistry and you love reactions, it's like, wow, that's really cool. But I know a lot of people struggle with organic chemistry, which just means you need to hit it even harder. Some people are really amazing with physics right away, but the whole point is with all of these questions, it's the only way to get better is through actual practice problems, not just reading a book about it.
I think even better than practice problems is practicing it in real life in a lab. And so I didn't get to relate this to my chem phys sections at all. But as far as my biology sections on the MCAT, there was a lot of genetic testing and they just gave you this southern blot or northern blot. And I'm like, I did this all the time. I did this day in and day out. And so I felt super comfortable with that kind of data. But if they showed me a mechanism for organic chemistry 1, that was 2-3 years ago from the time I took the test, I felt a lot less comfortable. So no matter how many problems I did over the 6 months leading up to the MCAT, I think real life practice is always going to be the better bet.
Yeah. So with that being said, one thing I kind of want to touch on, and we'll go back to it in when we talk about tips and tricks, but you don't have a calculator for the test. And some people are surprised by that, but you do not have a calculator. And so how do you get around that? How do you deal with something like 8.4 million divided by 2.4 times 10 to the negative fifth? And the answer is just convert everything into scientific notation. You need to know scientific notation front and back. And typically the numbers that they give you, 8.4 divided by 2.1, it's always going to end up something that is very easy to do mathematically as long as you get order of magnitude right. And another really important thing is to make sure that your units for everything, especially in physics, are in the correct units. I would almost always convert everything to SI units so that I know that it's correct. And typically, if you forget how an equation works, you forget what goes into each part of the equation, you could just look at units. You could look at the units of what they give you and look at the answer units, and that'll help you.
And I think you were a lot better at this than me initially, and I think you were doing it for a little bit in some of your other classes. And you just told me that one day. You're like, convert it all to scientific notation and figure it out. And I'm looking at you, and I'm looking at my paper, and I'm like, what am I looking at? You know, and it just takes months of practice, and it really does get a lot easier. And there's a couple YouTube videos that I watched that were tremendously helpful as far as getting comfortable. And they give you practice problems in kind of a couple of these YouTube videos. And you should just sit there, sure, like 30 minutes of just sitting there converting stuff to scientific notation and practically doing simple math at the end of the day, but you're guesstimating within a 10% range is going to be tremendously helpful.
That's the other big thing. We're talking about estimates. Typically, the actual answers, they're either going to be orders of magnitude apart, meaning 2.4, 24, 240, 2400. So if you have the order of magnitude right, you know, based on your scientific notation, there's your answer. Or typically the answers will be so different that as long as you estimate, you can get, like you said, within a 10% range and choose the correct answer from there.
So don't drop a zero. That's all I got to say. Don't miss out on one of those zeros.
Yes, do not miss out on the zeros. So with that being said, and I'm sure we're going to come up with some more tips and tricks to talk about relating to Chem Phys, let's go into both of our favorite section, CARS. So CARS stands for Critical Analysis and Reasoning section. And I don't know, Brian, why don't you tell us about CARS?
So intuitively, we've all taken standard tests throughout grade school up through 12th grade. I'm presuming if you're in college and you're listening to this, you've all taken standardized tests and you had to read a passage and you've had to pluck out specifics about the author's tone, what the author's trying to convey, among other things, like themes of the passage. And it sounds so easy. The first time I heard about it, I'm like, Cars, easy. I'm a native English speaker. There's no reason that I cannot score well on this portion of the test. There's no reason. And my God, was I wrong. I dreaded it. Every time I had to study for Cars, and like you do have to study for Cars. And I think that was one of my pitfalls in my own studying, is that I just didn't think I could do better by repeating passages over passages over passages. And I think that's part of the reasons why that was my lowest scoring portion of the test. I just didn't dedicate enough time to it.
It was my lowest scoring portion as well. And it's one of those things that everybody struggles with. And when we talk about resources later, I'm going to mention something similar, but I want to get it out of the way now. The AAMC, they have their own essentially logic for Cars. Logic meaning their explanations of why this answer is correct. It's not necessarily correct even. It's the reason that this answer is better than the others is very specific to AAMC logic. Meaning that if you're to use other resources for something like chemistry, physics, biology, psych, soc, they're pretty much going to, if it's a good resource, track well with what the AAMC presents you. I would say for Cars, you're going to want to spend more time on AAMC material. And I've even seen some people suggest, from a reading standpoint, just subscribe to the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal and just read one or two long articles a day, just to prime your brain for that quick reading and looking for particular things.
That's a good point you make. So it's not just being able to do it, but you have to do it quickly. You have an hour and a half to get through, what is it, 9 passages?
It varies per test, but it's around... The chunk of text is always going to be the same, shorter, longer passages.
And you're going to have 53 questions. And I've ran out of time. I had a speed read through my last one, and I wasn't able to go into it as much as I liked. And so just to quote my organic chemistry professor, logic, logic, nothing but logic on all these tests, right? So they're not really throwing you crazy curveballs, and practice is going to be your best answer. You have to read the passages. You have to put the work in. You have to put the time in. And as a full-time student and a full-time worker and working in a lab, I know it's hard. I lived through it, and it was not a great time in my life, but it's one test. It's one time in your life, and you're going to be a doctor. I believe in you.
And the thing is, you know, we haven't mentioned this yet, but the actual test, the interface of the test, it has a highlight section, which you could either click the highlight or do Control H. And it also has a strike through. And so if you see an answer that you just don't like, you can actually strike it out. But you're essentially going to need to highlight so much for Cars. And what I would just say for Cars, highlight anytime the author is showing their own opinion. That's huge, because you're getting an insight into the author's tone. I would definitely highlight names of people, of places, things like that. If they mention a quote from George Washington, go ahead and just highlight George Washington. You don't need to highlight the whole quote, but get that down. And what I did personally, for every paragraph I did, I said, what did I just read? What was the main purpose of that little passage? How does it fit into the bigger picture? And did the author argue anything here?
Another good point there would be, always look at the title. It's quick, it's easy, it's kind of silly to say it out loud, but once you get into the habit of things, you just go right into the text and you just skim over the title. But look at the title, who published it, because it's at the very bottom of the text, and what year it was published. And sometimes that clues you in to what the author is trying to convey or what are the questions that they're going to ask you in the text.
The more context, the better. And really, like you said, it's kind of funny that you mentioned that, because you're eventually going to get to a point when you've practiced enough, you'll be reading the body of text and you'll be able to predict the question type that they'll be asking.
If you study the MCAT enough, it becomes your whole life, right? Like, you're looking at life in the lens of MCAT questions at the end of the day, and it makes you sick. But it goes away. I promise you, it goes away after a couple of weeks of not looking at the content. Like, it was a lot of the psych-soc terms, honestly, at the end of the day.
Yeah, and so that's pretty much all we have for Cars. It is one of those things that you need to practice. And when we get into resources, we'll tell you what you could use to practice. But let's talk about, well, most of pre-med's favorite section, because majority of pre-meds are biology or life science majors. Let's talk about biology and biochemistry. So I know this is, I think, one of your best, if not your best section, and I think it was definitely my best section. So what do you remember from biology, biochemistry?
So once again, a lot of passages and a lot of data, and these graphs that they give you for the data is, they are poor graphs. And I was getting so frustrated, and it was double line graphs with legends that just didn't make any sense. And so, like, instead of spending time getting frustrated with the poor data that they're publishing and putting inside of these things, you just got to look over them and dive in and try to see what they're really trying to tell you. As far as content, it was vast. It was really vast. It was spreading from, like I was saying, immunology, genetics really did help me as well. Having knowledge in the different kind of genetic testing, the southern blots, northern blots, and western blots, is decently important there.
So the biology section, yeah, like you said, it has a lot of graphs, meaning that you have passages relating to experiments. And these are real experiments that have been done in the world that they pull from. And it's important, like when you're reading any type of paper or graph, one of the most important things to look at, like you said, are the axes. You're trying to look at, you know, what each, I don't know, bar graph is showing. And then I think the most important thing, which a lot of people neglect, is the statistical significance, right? Think of your p-value.
Right, what is your p-value?
Think of your little star. The star between one group, the star between groups 1 and 3, 2 and 3.
And this is where the real life application of science really did help me. So working in a lab for a good six, I'd probably say a year before taking the test, we were doing genetic testing on mice. And so we do gene knockouts. And so I was so used to looking at, oh, this is my SRY positive mice versus my SRY knockout mice. And so, like, they had a lot of the mice studies in this section of the test. And so it would just say KO S or whatever gene that they knocked out. And then it would show you the DNA or the proteins that they're expressing at the end. And you're trying to analyze that and answer the questions. And I think having that real world experience really does help.
Yeah. And the way I like to approach these things, and this is kind of my approach to especially the biology biochemistry section, I like to look at a lot of things directionally. Meaning, if I know that a knockout is going to send some metabolic parameter into a certain place directionally, I write it down. I say knockout, we should have glucose uptake go down, fasting insulin go up, something like that. I like to look at things with arrows. I'm very visual. I like to have everything in front of me directionally, because it is difficult, you know, working memory to keep all these things in your brain as you go through. But if you write it down, you'll be able to essentially interpret the graph in your own terms and on your own section. One thing I want to say here before I forget, it is a absolute prerequisite, no questions asked. You have to know every amino acid front and back. You have to know what it looks like with just lines. You have to know what it looks like with the skeleton / Lewis structure. You need to know the acidic ones, the basic ones, polar, which ones have sulfur, which ones are nucleophiles, which ones are electrophiles. You need to know all of these things front and back, not only because you will be tested on it discreetly, but also because if you are very comfortable with the amino acids, so many questions become that much easier, because really they might seem like they're asking you something complicated, but at the end of the day, they're testing your knowledge on amino acids, and it's a very important thing.
It could seem like a super complicated question, but all if it's just, oh, I have a K175P mutation, right? And then that's basically what it's asking about. What's changing about the characteristics of that amino acid, right? I have a lysine changed to a phenylalanine. Okay, that, if you know your amino acids well enough, that should be cake. That should be a thought in your mind, right? You shouldn't have to sit there thinking about and rereading the entire passage to see where did I go wrong? What did I miss? Because you don't have time for that. You really don't.
I'll let that one slide. It's a K to a P is to a proline, and, you know, phenylalanine is an F. But
see?
That's okay.
Yeah, see, this is how I've been out.
Yeah, but so stuff like that. You should know the one-letter code, the three-letter code. You do not need to know, like, what RNA encodes for various amino acids. That would be ridiculous. It's like a 64. you know, thing. But if you need that, they'll give it to you. Another thing is just pretty much all aspects of cell biology. You should know the, you know, endomembrane system. You should know directionally. I mean, you should know all the tenets of the, you know, central dogma of biology, DNA to RNA to protein. But you should also know about some other mediators of that. We have things like microRNA, small interrupting RNA, things like tRNA, things like the ribosomes, the A site, P site, E site. And again, you don't need to go so in depth as figuring out the mechanism of how the amino acid chain is building, both these different building blocks, but you should at least know the zoomed out picture.
In some of these passages, it'll tell you what these things are. And some, like, I think one of them was like diabetes and one of my practice AMC ones. And it goes over, I'm like, I know what diabetes is. Thank you. I've been a paramedic for about 5 years now. I don't need a background in diabetes. But that being said, so you don't need to know everything about all these little things, because sometimes it'll just tell you. Like, I think there's one on like COP2 coated vesicles. And like, if you've never known what a COP2 coated vesicle was, you have no idea. But then it goes on to the next sentence telling you the gist of what they do.
Right. And a lot of times you might be able to find one or two things to highlight from that section, but it's just like cars. You need to know how to quickly pull information and move on to the next section. Another thing that I would say that I initially struggled with is looking at flowcharts or looking at images of these gene pathways and knowing what all the different symbols mean. The plus versus like that little like stop thing. It's like the line and then the perpendicular line. That means it stops this. And a lot of times you can kind of tell yourself, I like to think of these things as control diagrams, control systems. If this goes up, then this is going to go up. If that goes up, then this is going to go down. If that goes down, what's the physiologic effect? Just follow that chart down with the symbols. Think of it like a control system, and it's not going to be that bad. I will say, like you said, biology is so broad, and it, like I said before, the majority of pre-med students are biology majors, which means you have to score that much better to get into a higher percentile for this one, unfortunately.
Yeah, most students do take it around their junior year of their undergraduate degree, and so you're not going to make it to your third year in your biology degree and not know what a kinase is or a phosphatase is, or let alone diabetes is. Like, they're going to go into all this stuff into your classes if you're just starting out your degree. And so you don't need to worry about all that, because it will come to you. Right? Don't take a deep breath. Don't stress out about it too much. Trust the process. Trust yourself at the end of the day, and do your own due diligence. Do work hard. It is a hard test. It really is.
It is. And so I think that was a pretty good review of biology, biochemistry. Now we'll go into a section which, full honesty, this is what I struggled with the most in the beginning. And it took me a long time, and I mean truly Anki saved me here, but psychology and sociology. And those are two, there are some overlaps, but at the end of the day, those are two disparate fields. And if you take a psychology class, it's likely that you're not going to touch much on sociology, and vice versa. And like you were saying before, I had the similar experience where in my psychology class, we did not cover, I wouldn't say a tenth of the content on.
That's being generous. Right. Yeah, there's no way.
And it really is important. The reason, you know, a lot of people wonder, why do we have cars, or why do we have psychology and sociology? Cars, I could definitely argue for being able to interpret data quickly from a big data set, learning how to read scientific papers and pull out what's correct. But for psychology and sociology, it's a fact that physicians need to understand the intersectionality between things like socioeconomic status, racial, all these other things with their ability to access healthcare. They need to understand bias. They need to understand struggles that their patients are going to face in real life.
And even like going back to the passages point, like as a medical doctor, you need to be able to, while mentally exhausted, listen to a patient's story or their narrative and pull out the important pieces of information, even if they are a poor historian or English is not their first language and you're not getting the full picture, and you need to be able to piece this together effectively and provide an effective treatment plan for that patient and do no harm at the end of the day.
Right. So for psychology and sociology, I'm going to say it again. So I will link to this, but there is a 300 page document. I think it might be a little over 300 pages. And it essentially lays out everything you need to know for psychology and sociology. Granted, they might throw in one or two loop questions, experimental questions that you might not have been prepared with. But from a definition and names standpoint, because there's a lot of names in psychology, Yorks, Dodson, Pavlov, all these people, Maslow, all these people, you really need to know a lot of them. And it, what's great about this document is it puts in bold the things you need to know. If you need to know about a theory, but you don't need to know who came up with this theory, it's not in bold. And so this 300-page document, I made an Anki card for every single thing I felt like I needed to know. And you need to start doing that. I would recommend to give yourself more time, 6 months out minimum. It should be, as you're starting to study for the MCAT, it should be one of the first things that you do. Do you have any input on the study techniques for psych soc?
I think Anki is going to be your strongest mediator for studying solely for psych soc at the end of the day. I think it helps with the other sections, but psych soc hits the hardest. And it is just the whole definition, answer, and hammering that in for all thousands of these terms, right? And so being able to do that, you can't do that in a couple months. You just can't do it in 2 or 3 months. You need a longer time. You need to have it in there. And there's even connections that I make today from that information that I studied 6 months ago. And I'm like, oh, it's still there. That's great. And there's these things that I don't still remember and I need to probably brush up on it. But
and the other important thing with psych soc, I think, is, again, this goes back to biology and really every section away, is a lot of times they present experiments and they present these graphs and, you know, it's just another way that they're testing your ability to pull information from the data that they give you, right?
Yeah, and find what works for you. So if the flashcards work for you, great. If writing your own notes, having to rewrite it for you, that works for you, use that. Don't use whatever this person on YouTube told you to use because that's what that got them a 527. At the end of the day, you know it works for you if you got to this point. If it's the YouTube videos that do work, the Khan Academy videos are fantastic.
Amazing for psych soc.
Right. There's a video for every single major topic. And I've had to watch a couple of them like a couple times over because I'm just like, what did I just listen to?
Right.
Mind you, I've been up for like 23 hours. I just got off a 12-hour shift. I'm on my sixth can of Red Bull. But we made it through.
I would not suggest that that pre-studying technique. So now that we've kind of done a really big overview about the sections, I really want to talk about what does your study plan look like and what steps do you take to succeed? So I think for both of us, we started studying around, honestly, a lot of what Ryan and I did, we did a lot of individual study, but we always made time weekly to study together. And I actually think there's a lot of benefit in that. I don't think you should study everything with somebody because you have your own strengths and weaknesses, but it's good to keep yourself accountable, to keep your friend accountable. And I mean, you feel like you're in this with somebody because all the people in the world, all the people in your life, they know that you're going to take the MCAT and they know that it's very stressful. But until you're actually in the thick of it, you don't realize how much of your life it is going to take away from.
And it's hard for family members and other friends that don't know truly what the test entails and how much time you need to dedicate to that test. Having someone there with you that's also taking the test is fantastic. They know exactly what you're going through. They know how much time you truly dedicate because they're doing the same thing. But mom or dad that's never taken this test, they're just assuming it's just another standardized test. They don't understand why you're so stressed out about this on top of going to work, on top of trying to maintain A's in your classes. Like it's not an easy thing to do. So for me, like starting 6 months out was fantastic. So with a busy schedule, it's nice to be able to dedicate 2 to 3 hours of that was lighter studying. I'll be honest. It was lighter reading of the Kaplan books, right? There's these sets of books that you can buy online. You can probably find them on like Facebook Marketplace from these students that have already taken the test or from like other classmates of yours, right? So they've already taken the test. Hey, do you mind if I use these? Save you a couple $100 at the end of the day. Anki's,
the next great tool. And there's these preset made decks. You can go on
Jack Sparrow and Pre-Medbro, something like that.
So if you just type in on Google, like Anki Decks MCAT Reddit, it'll pop up a few, and you can download a few and see what people like, see what you like at the end of the day. And there's thousands of these cards, and it'll organize them well and get really comfortable with this program, because you'll definitely be using it in the medical school process as well.
Yeah, and one of the first things that we both did is we took a test called Blueprint. I don't know if there's... It's essentially, they have like a practice full-length exam that you take to figure out what you're weak in, okay? We're going to talk in a second about AAMC material, but you really want to save that AAMC material for when you are closer to the test and you feel more comfortable, because that is most representative of what is actually going to be on the test. It's from the same people.
And it use those tests towards the end to build up your test stamina as well, right? So this is a 7-hour and 45-minute test. That's not something where you can just execute all of your brain power straight for 7 hours and be able to function well. So if you
don't have practice.
Exactly. Yeah. So like saving those towards the end are super important. The Blueprint was good. I think we also took a Kaplan one a few months out as well. I think that might have been a half one though.
That was early on, and some different resources have half ones. And what I'll say about them is, as far as any of the full length you take before AAMC, what they're most helpful for, in my opinion, is telling you what you're weak in. If you took that test and you got every single question about fluid dynamics wrong, well, now you know you need to go and do fluid dynamics. And so after that, that's where you can start tackling these review books. And my strategy that I use to approach this is a little different from maybe what other people's. I wanted to go through and optimize my time, essentially. And so how I did it is I went through the Kaplan books, and before I looked at the section, if I knew I was comfortable with it, I immediately went to the questions and I took a little practice test. And if I was really fine on that section, I got 10 out of 12 right, then I would just skim through the section and write some little notes down. If I did horribly on that test, that's how I need to know, hey, I'm weak on this section and I need to go through there. And for me, I did a general chemistry review, I did an organic chemistry review, and I did a psychology and sociology review, and that is it for the Kaplan books. But again, everybody has their own opinion here. General chemistry, because I knew it was somewhere in the back of my brain, but I just needed to pull a little closer to the front. What was your, how did you approach these book?
So starting months out again, right, I went through each section and I made sure to reread, because like 6 months out, you're going to forget some of that information that you read at the start of the 6 months as you get closer to like the 2 month mark from your test. And so reviewing some of those older books just to be able to pull that information quicker and more efficiently is super important. I think I went over a couple different of the physics books because that was my first time in physics during that time of studying. And then I didn't even take the physics two. So I bought the Kaplan one, and then I had a Blueprint one that I got from a friend, and I wasn't a big fan of the Blueprint book.
I really think the Kaplan ones are from my opinion, top of the line as far as books go.
And then watching organic chemistry tutor is my man. I love organic chemistry tutor YouTube videos.
Many of people can credit him for getting into medical school.
For passing my classes, a lot of them. Straight up, that man has got me through general chemistry, organic chemistry, and physics, just to name those three. Like that, there's definitely plenty more within my degree, but find what videos speak to you. If you don't like him, there's other resources as well.
And another online resources that I'm sure that many of you have heard about that I would absolutely recommend, and it is more of a premium price, is UWorld. And UWorld, I think Ryan and I can both speak to UWorld. UWorld, in my opinion, represents the most difficult of questions that could show up on the MCAT.
You will question your own intelligence after taking one of those tests.
It is very difficult from both a calculation standpoint, a discrete knowledge standpoint, and a passage standpoint.
The passages will desecrate you, yeah? You'll sit there reading, you'll be on your fifth passage and you'll question why you're wanting to do this, and you really have to dig deep.
And the reason it's important is because, one, it builds your confidence when you start doing better on UWorld, and two, if you practice for 5 months doing 70 to 80 questions of UWorld per day, and then you start doing AAMC material and it feels easier, then all the better. You're already more prepared than a lot of your peers there.
And to speak on the price tag, so I think it was around $350 for a 6 month subscription of UWorld, which for a full-time student and even working full-time, that's a hefty price tag in 2024 with our rising cost of inflation. But that is the most beneficial resource you can probably pull from. The books, even paying for the MCAT itself, is another $350. Like, all the, this is a very expensive process. But if you could single out anything that you need to buy on your own, it's going to be one of the subscription to UWorld. You can find the book somewhere else. You can probably find them online for free. But UWorld, you're going to have to pay for the subscription.
Yeah, and one of the other things to look at on UWorld is you're going to get ranked, essentially percentile-wise, compared to other UWorld users. So let me repeat that. You get ranked on a percentile basis compared to other UWorld users. But a minute ago, I just said that not everybody uses UWorld, and the students that use UWorld are going to be better prepared for the test. So what does that mean? If you're scoring in the 70 to 80, above 80 is incredible on UWorld, that means you're already that much more prepared. I don't know the exact correlation, you know, between percentile on UWorld and what you can expect to score on the test, but directionally, you know, you're in the right place. That's not to say that if you have a test that you get a 50% on, you need to just, you know, spiral, but it kind of tells you, hey, look, what am I weak in and how can I correct this? Also, the other cool thing about UWorld is you can break up each section very specifically. So if I'm really good on, let's say, mechanics, but I'm not as good on electricity and magnetism, then I'm going to put in more questions there. You can really customize it, which I thought was cool.
And one of my favorite things about UWorld is that you can make it tutored. You can tutored untimed question bank tests. So you take this test, you make your own like 20 question practice tests, let's say, for example, and you get the question wrong. It will go over each and every single one of the answers, why it's wrong and why the right one is right, on top of giving you more diagrams and more background information about that. And then you can make flashcards within the own program. And that was fantastic. And I like to import those into my Anki because I like my Anki better than UWorld at the end of the day. But it's a fantastic program.
And that's a good point. Whether you do tutored or untutored, I would definitely suggest doing tutored so you get feedback immediately after the question. But it's almost a prerequisite to say, hey, look, you don't need to, it's untimed. You got to make it untimed because the time that you're going to spend on a UWorld question is not at all representative of what you're going to spend on an AAMC full length. What could be 2 to 2.5 hours on UWorld might be one actual section on the AAMC. And so getting into AAMC, you know, Ryan said that you should definitely shell out some funds for UWorld, which I agree with. I would say if you can afford it, try to also get the AAMC guide. I think it's called Guide to the MCAT Pack, because what you're going to get in that are 6 full-length examinations. You're going to get question banks from every section, and you're going to get 240 CARS passages of AAMC reading material and logic. And that is really good. That really helped me with CARS because it is AAMC logic and you can really gauge where you are time-wise on that as well.
So I don't think I could have, I wasn't able to afford that at the time. And so I only bought the individual tests as the weeks came up. And that's where I was at with my finances, unfortunately. But we're all at different places. We're all at different points in our life. And so if you can 100% get the UWorld, get the full-blown, get the question banks, and they are helpful. He sent me a few of them and they were helpful. But if you can't, you need to buy every single one of those tests. There's a free sample test. Definitely take that. When would you say you would want to take that?
So my opinion on this and my tutor, which I'll talk about tutoring in a bit, shared this opinion. You should, so there's six exams, right? There's six full-length exams. You should start taking those 6 weeks out from 3 weeks before your test, meaning that if I'm testing at the end of May, I want to finish my last full-length on the weekend of that first week of May. And so logistically, what does that look like?
You can just say 9 weeks away.
9 weeks away. That does work as well. Logistically, though, what does that look like? So our strategy, and a strategy that I would recommend, is you just got to accept that your Saturdays and Sundays for those 9 weeks before the test are no longer yours. They are the test.
Property of AMC at this point.
Exactly. And so what does that look like? So Saturday morning, you wake up, you have some breakfast. This is when you need to start replicating what you're going to do on test day. So if I'm going to have a couple eggs and some cheese and, you know, whatever in the morning, I'm going to start doing that. If I'm going to try to wake up at a certain time, granted, I took the full lengths later than I had to wake up for the actual test, but that's what you should be doing to get your body and your mind prepared for the reality of test day. And so we would do them. We would wake up in the morning and we would take these tests, and they are full length tests, and they are exactly, logistically wise, how the test works. And Ryan, why don't you talk about, because this is a good point to talk about, what are you given on test day as far as note taking, and how did we deal with that during the full length practices?
Before I get into that, you reminded me of something. Like, you spend all this time optimizing your knowledge and your endurance for the test, but I think it's important to take note of optimizing your nutrition so you're the best that you can be for that morning of test day. So walking in there, whether that be get your diet right, get your exercise right. And I think that is a big overlooked point in a lot of people's lives, especially when you're studying so much. You're like, oh, I don't have time for the gym.
It's easy to neglect.
It is. And this might just be a personal thing for me, but if I don't go to the gym for a few days, I have so much brain fog, I can't even do simple tasks. And it's silly, but like, you need to hit the gym. You need to get your cardio up. You need to eat optimally. And so I know we've talked about this before, but everyone has these big carbohydrate meals around lunch. And this was seen on my test day. And they're all, you have that post-lunch slump and everyone's super tired and you have that brain fog and you're just foggy for the rest of the day and you can't wait to go home and take a nap, sit down and watch Netflix. But if you don't have that large carbohydrate meal and you just stay in, practically optimally would be ketosis, but just limit your carbs on the day of test day so you're not running off of glycolysis.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you really do need that brain power for the entire time. And these full lengths are where you practice what works for you. So we would typically do the full lengths. We would use our iPads to write everything down on just one sheet. And same thing, no resources, no Google, no calculators. You need to treat this like a real test, period. You need to take the small breaks in between and do something similar away from your phone. You need to take the lunch break and figure out how much time do I actually have to eat and everything and get ready for the next section. You need to treat these like the real thing. And when you are done with the test, it's going to take a couple seconds and it's going to populate with your score. It is going to populate with the score that you got compared to all the other users that have taken this test before. And Ryan, you and I both had moments where we thought we did well on a test and we didn't do too well when the score popped up, or we thought we did really poorly and we ended up getting some of our best scores. So how do you deal with the mentality of seeing your score right away?
Circling back on the first question that you asked actually before, I think actually I'll just answer this one. So it's important to just take a deep breath. At the end of the day, it is what it is. You can't change whatever the score is in front of you. You did your best. You need to figure out, especially for the practice ones, where you went wrong, what are the wrong questions that you answered, and what are the right questions that you answered, and did you answer them for the right reasons? And so you truly have no idea. Like you were saying, like, oh, I felt really good about this. I got this after the 10-minute breaks, where you're calling each other on the
practice test days, and we're like, that was easy. That was cake. We got this. This is nothing. And then you turn around, you're like, oh, I didn't do so hot. Like, where did I go wrong? Why is my logic different from the AMC logic? And really dialing that is super important for the test. But you are not what the test score is. Like, you're bigger than whatever this MCAT is to you. At the end of the day, this is just a standardized test. You can always improve. You can retake the test in case you do poorly. Not that I'd ever really want to ever do that again, and I'm not going to do it. But really just taking a moment to woosah for yourself, taking a lap around the house, take those 10-minute breaks, take the 30-minute breaks, eat your lunch, get the nerves out of the way is super important. And then circling back, day of test day, this is super important because no one really talks about this, and no one even talked about the MCAT, and that's why we're here today in the first place. But as soon as you walk in that testing center, you can't have anything on you. You can't bring out your phone, so you can't tell family, like, hey, I made it. So make sure you make all those texts and arrangements beforehand. Make sure you bring everything that you need to bring inside, such as your lunch inside and your drinks inside, because you can't go back out to your car. And so you're only allowed a picture, like your picture ID. And then once you walk inside, get checked in, and they do, right now they're doing palm vein scans to make sure it's you. And they give you an expo marker and a whiteboard for mine.
Whiteboard. Well, we had about 8 pages of, it's essentially, and it does vary by test location, but it was essentially dry erase, you know, paper that you could write on. And they'll refill those. As soon as you're done, you know, if you write big, you don't need to worry about running out of room, because if you run out of room, you could just talk to the proctor and say, hey, look, I need more. Well, let's get back to testing in just a second. I want to just mention one last thing. When you're finished with these tests on Saturday, you're done for the day. You're done mentally, and you need to be done. You need to be able to step away from it and go enjoy your life. Take the rest of that Saturday night within reason and truly live, because it is so easy to get so caught up on this. You want to review right away, but you're not optimized at that point. You are at the very end of your executive functioning, and it's that you're done after that. So take the rest of that Saturday off, take a breather, and then wake up Sunday and be ready to review for a good 2 to 6 hours, depending on how much you really need to go into the test. Look at every single question you got right and wrong. Look at the ones you flagged. Look at all the what you highlighted, and figure out where you went wrong or where you went right.
I mean, it's an important thing at the end of the 8 hours. Yes, go live life, but take care of the things that you need to take care of at the end of the day, but don't continue sitting there and freaking out about whatever score that you got, or getting way too excited and doubling down on whatever studying that you need to do for that day. It's not going to stick well, but I don't know you, and you don't know how my brain works, or I don't know how your brain works, but do what works for you. It's important to keep your social connections though, at the end of the day. Like you were saying, it's easy to get lost in the sauce of the MCAT and push away your friends, push away your family. And it's hard to maintain these social relationships as an adult. And you got all these things that you're juggling, especially if you have kids. Like that's a damn near, it's really hard. It's not impossible, but it's a really hard thing to do. And so going back to those social relationships, go hang out with your friends, go out, have a beer with them, and maintain contact with your family.
And I mean, that's going to be an important thing, because it doesn't end at the MCAT. You're going to have so much time you need to dedicate to medical school, and then it's going to be the step exams, and then it's going to be residency, and then, hey, look, it's going to be your life. This is your life now. So practicing that balance between your obligations to your career and towards your academics, and balancing those obligations to your family, to your partner, to your friends, this is where you start practicing that. And I think it's even more important now, because you don't have that, you might not have that resilience yet. I had to lean heavily on everybody in my life to get through this unscathed and, you know, happy at the end of the day. So with that being said, let's dive into test day. You went over a lot of things, but let's just talk about test day logistics, and then we'll wrap it up talking about what we got, what we're looking forward to in the next episode, and also how the score distribution works, because that is also an interesting thing that people don't really consider.
So one of my favorite things about walking into the test center was their ginormous, gorgeous, noise canceling earphones. These things are the best things in the world. Because that was one of my big worries. Because when I was taking my practice test, if there's something going on outside, even if the wind's too loud, maybe that's just my ADHD talking, but I would get upset. I'm like, I can't focus and read this cards passage seven times in a row. I don't have the time for that. These noise canceling earphones are the absolute, I could hear my own pulse.
And that was about it. You couldn't nothing, hear anything else.
Nothing else. One of the, I was raising my hand to like get let go on one of my breaks, and one of the ladies came out to get me. I didn't hear her walk up. I didn't see her hand go in front of my face. And so she shook my shoulder and I jumped. I couldn't hear anything, but I jumped.
And that's another really important thing. Any breaks that happen, whether unscheduled, meaning not in your regular break time, or scheduled, you need to be signed out. You have to raise your hand. The proctor has to walk over to you, sign you out, walk you out of the room. You go and you have your break. Then you have to come back, be patted down again, and then you need to go back in there and be signed in. Think about that. That's not something you could really practice for in your practice exams, but you need to take into account any breaks, especially unplanned breaks, are going to take time. And guess what? Nobody's going to tell you, hey, you're ending the end of your 10-minute break. They also don't tell you how far into your lunch you are. So you need to take a mental note of that there's a clock in there. What time did I start my lunch and what time did I go back? Because I didn't know and I was freaking out and I was like, okay, I got to eat quick. In that room, every minute feels like forever. And so I finished my lunch in 15 minutes and went back. I would have loved those extra 10 minutes to just decompress and get ready for the next section. But I wasn't paying attention to the time.
Maybe that's just Yerkes Dodson. That's optimal arousal theory right there, baby. I don't know. Maybe we're giving them too much.
Right.
I definitely took my full 30. I did some stretches. I noted exactly what time I needed to be back in there. I went in about 5 minutes early. But yeah, I did some good deep breathing exercises. Got my little woosah in. But
and when you go in, there's no, you're starting. Meaning that when your break is done, like when you say your break is done, it's immediately into the test.
Sit down. Let's go. Let's do it. Send it.
Yeah. And so I guess the last kind of thing to talk about MCAT specific is the score distribution. Now, this is tough. And I'm going to acknowledge that it's tough. And it's tough for everybody. You don't get your scores until 5 weeks after the test is done. And why is that? So we don't really know at the end of the day. But if you think about it, if there's any disputes with the test, that takes a long time to go through. If you have a problem with the question, if you think a question was wrong, if you think there was something wrong with your testing center, and you feel like it's unfairly going to be graded, or the testing center had a problem with you or another student, these things take a while to transpire. And then they have to build that scale that I was talking about based on all these questions. So you could see, you know, it takes a while, but as you'll figure out in other portions of the series, there's a lot of waiting in this process, and so you have to get used to it. And so do you remember, Ryan, like what was your kind of vibe or what was your feel during those 5 weeks? Like how often did you think about your score?
Every day.
Yeah.
Every single day. And it was a long month. It was a long month, but I was busy. I had stuff to do. I had applications due around that time. My primaries were coming up. I had stuff from my family that I had to go do, and I had finals even. And so like it was nonstop. And so I didn't have too much time to sit there and dwell like, oh, where's my test coming back? But as far as if there are problems, I mean, don't wait around for 2 weeks before you contact your testing center or the AAMC and say, hey, I had this problem 2 weeks out. And so that's going to further cause issues and further push back the result date, right? So the sooner we can all collectively as pre-meds get the issues out of the way, maybe we can get our scores back a little earlier. But that's just...
Yeah, and so when you're ready to get your score, you're going to log into the AAMC website. You're going to go to the official MCAT section, and then you're going to go to score report. And so you're going to pull up the score and
have a heart attack.
And what's the up? And take some deep breaths before. And what's interesting here is they give you something that you've never had on a practice test before, which is a score range and confidence band. Now, I'm not going to go much into it, but you have to remember that these, you know, scores are all based on not a curve, but a weighted average. And if you've ever taken statistics, you know that there are residues and you know that there's a standard deviation. And that is the curve. That is the range that they're showing you when they talk about the range and the confidence band. Unfortunately, it doesn't matter much to the schools that are looking at it, to my knowledge. From what I know, if your range is from 517 to 521, but the aggregate score that they give you is a 519, that is what you're going to put on the application, and that's what the schools are going to go off to. So it's kind of an interesting thing. I wouldn't put much thought into it, but that is what you're going to see, and I don't want it to alarm you that day of. So I think that's pretty much it. And, you know, we went over a lot. This was a long podcast, but, you know, this is a big topic, and we're going to give you as many resources as possible in the show notes and on the website. And if you have any questions, you could definitely, any of you could reach out to us, and we'd be really happy to put you in touch or give you the right resources to succeed. I mean, at the end of the day, right, Ryan, it's like, we truly are in this together. And even though it's a competitive process, everything in medicine is competitive, but you need to be able to lean on your peers and think of them as your allies in this and not an antagonistic viewpoint.
We're here to build a better future, and that's why we're making this podcast in the first place. We need good doctors out there. We need really good, smart, intelligent people leading the emergency rooms, leading those even family clinics. And so if we can help any single one of you be there for the patients out there in the United States and all over the world, then I'm happy to be here, sitting here, taking my time away to make it happen. So if you do have any questions, please reach out to us. I think our email is on our website, and we'll probably
link to it in the show notes.
Yeah.
One last little thing I did forget, you know, this is all off script, is if you're applying to a DO program, you need to send your score report to the ACOMAS application portal, because it's different from AMCAS. And we're going to get into our next episode.
Yeah, we'll have a
we're going to get into the primary applications for AMCAS, which is MD, and ACOMAS, which is DO. We're not going to touch on the TMS DASS because we did not apply to that process for Texas medical schools, but that is what we're looking forward to in the future. But as always, we're very happy that you listened in. And if you're practicing for the MCAT, all we could say is good luck, and we're sure that you'll succeed.